unless something else happens, unless the lawyers could bring the issue to the Tenth Circuit, which they did not. They went straight to the Supreme Court yesterday and just show all the new witnesses that show the complete unreliability of the man, Justin Snead, which the state themselves characterized as inherently suspect, and just show that, you know, in one of the...
We have 10 seconds.
Okay, Criminal Court of Appeals, in the dissent, one of them said this man did not have a fair trial. Obviously, there needs to be a way that the new evidence can be looked at, because this really might be an innocent man.
Sister Helen Prejean, will leave it there. One of the world's most well-known anti-death penalty activists speaking to us from Oklahoma. She was to be one of the witnesses at Richard Glossop's execution, but he was not killed. This is Democracy Now! Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke, Carla Wells, Laura Gottes, Dina Guster, Amy Littlefield. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Thanks for joining us.
This cable program has been made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Grindle's, a neighborhood coffee house offering organic coffee, sandwiches for breakfast and lunch, and Wi-Fi. Proud to support KABU, Grindle's is open every day at East Burnside and 8th. Information at 503-595-9550 or facebook.com/Grindle's Coffee House. It's 5 o'clock p.m. You are listening to KBOO Portland, and the Thursday evening news is next.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Gaining Ground, a feature-length documentary film by Elaine Velasquez and Barbara Bernstein on Wednesday, September 30th, and Thursday, October 1st at Cinema 21 in Portland. Gaining Ground tells the stories of farmers making extraordinary changes in their farming practice so they can feed their local communities sustainably grown produce and grains. The documentary interweaves experiences of urban farmer activists, large farms in transition, and small family farmers. Again, that's Gaining Ground, Wednesday, September 30th, and Thursday, October 1st, at Cinema 21, 616 Northwest 21st Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KABU Community Radio is seeking an individual or group to contract with to help build our next 3-year strategic plan. KABU embodies equitable social change, shares knowledge, and fosters creativity by delivering locally rooted and diverse music, culture, news, and opinions with a commitment to the voices of oppressed and underserved communities. We've been serving the Portland community since 1968 and are one of the oldest independent community radio stations in the country. The person or group who is selected will co-lead the development of a strategic plan with the KABU Strategic Planning Support Workgroup, made up of volunteers, board members, and staff. More details about the application process can be found at kbu.fm/planRFP2015.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KABU Evening News.
A shooting at Umpqua Community College in Roseburg has left 10 confirmed people dead. The shooter was confirmed killed by law enforcement this afternoon after students were evacuated.
We'll speak with somebody on the ground at the evacuation site and with the director of the Department of Public Safety.
We'll also cover the first day of retail marijuana sales in Oregon and ongoing protests against the removal of hundreds of Douglas fir trees in Clackamas County.
Good evening. This is the KABU Evening News for Thursday, October 1st, 2015. I'm Sari Gametha.
And I'm Sam Bowman. A shooting this morning at a community college in Roseburg took the lives of 10 people. 20 others were wounded. The attack took place around 10:30 this morning when a 20-year-old man entered Umpqua Community College and began shooting people. Governor Kate Brown stated in a press conference in Portland soon after the incident that, although it is still too early to know all of the facts, the effects of an incident such as this one are long-lasting.
Facts are still emerging. We know now there were casualties and confirmed injuries. Our top priority now is the medical treatment for victims and the security of the campus. We have confirmation that the shooter is deceased. He is a 20-year-old male. Our thoughts and prayers are with the victims and their families. We are holding the community of Douglas County in our hearts today. The work that first responders have done is harrowing. To our first responders, thank you for your work as this community reels from grief. I am leaving now to head to Roseburg to be with the community there. Oregon State Superintendent Rich Evans is here to make additional remarks. Please take care.
The first 911 calls came in the Roseburg area at 10:38 this morning. All law enforcement in the area responded immediately to the campus. The active shooter was engaged by law enforcement and later confirmed to be deceased. Our number one priority right now is to make sure that the scene is secure and the victims are treated, and making sure that we have a complete crime scene, and that we continue to make sure that there are no additional threats. The Oregon State Police is combining with all the local law enforcement, including the Douglas County Sheriff's Office, in making sure that we are doing all the things that the community needs us to do. We have set up a command center. We have set up an additional area for media relations. Our PIO is there, Lieutenant Bill Fugate, to assist you in the future. We're working through a family unification center. As we know, the families in these type of events become very frazzled, and they continue to make sure that we're communicating what we need to with them as we move forward. I would like to remind the media that these scenes are very dynamic and they change. Our number one priority is making sure that all victims are safe. And so additional information may take some time for us to make sure that we can get that information accurately to you. But our number one priority right now is making sure that we take care of the victims, the families, and the community of Roseburg.
That was audio from a press conference given by Governor Kate Brown this afternoon. President Obama also made a statement this afternoon about the Roseburg shooting, in which he responded to critics who accuse him of politicizing these tragedies.
And of course, what's also routine is that somebody somewhere will comment and say, Obama politicized this issue. Well, this is something we should politicize. It is relevant to our common life together, to the body politic. I would ask news organizations, because I won't put these facts forward, have news organizations tally up the number of Americans who've been killed through terrorist attacks over the last decade, and the number of Americans who've been killed by gun violence, and post those side by side on your news reports. This won't be information coming from me, it will be coming from you. We spend over $1 trillion and pass countless laws and devote entire agencies to preventing terrorist attacks on our soil, and rightfully so. And yet, we have a Congress that explicitly blocks us from even collecting data on how we could potentially reduce gun deaths. How can that be? This is a political choice that we make to allow this to happen every few months in America. We collectively are answerable to those families who lose their loved ones because of our inaction. When Americans are killed in mine disasters, we work to make mines safer. When Americans are killed in floods and hurricanes, we make communities safer. When roads are unsafe, we fix them to reduce auto fatalities. We have seatbelt laws because we know it saves lives. So the notion that gun violence is somehow different, that our freedom and our Constitution prohibits any modest regulation of how we use a deadly weapon, when there are law-abiding gun owners all across the country who could hunt and protect their families and do everything they do under such regulations. Doesn't make sense. So, tonight, as those of us who are lucky enough to hug our kids a little closer, are thinking about the families who aren't so fortunate, I'd ask the American people to think about how they can get our government to change these laws and to save lives.
That was President Obama speaking today on the murder of 13 students and wounding of 20 others in Roseburg, Oregon this morning.
Residents of Douglas County are still in shock over today's events, but they are pulling together. Vigils are being planned, the Red Cross is helping out, and grief counselors are on site. KABU reporter Doug McVeigh spoke with John Sajo, a Douglas County parent whose daughter attends Umpqua Community College, to find out more about the community's response.
John, your daughter attends Umpqua Community College. She was not in classes today?
That's right, although I didn't know it when I first heard about the tragedy, so I had a minute or two of terror until she called and said she was okay.
Well, that's good to know. So they brought the students to Douglas County Fairgrounds. Can you describe the scene there?
Yeah, there were hundreds of people there, families hoping to meet up with their student, and buses were dropping off people who had been at the campus. They weren't letting anybody leave in their cars or anything, so they were just dropping people off in buses. Strangely, a lot of people seemed happy because they had obviously just been reunited, and the Red Cross was there with free water and cookies, and there was free pizza and free coffee and lots of reporters, and mostly people elated to find out that their loved ones were okay, but some people for whom the news was obviously much worse.
Have people been able to focus on anything besides just relief at knowing whether their loved ones were okay?
Well, that's really the main thing, people reuniting with their loved ones and trying to figure out what happened. And, the community is starting to pull together. I know people are already planning a candlelight vigil for tonight at Stewart Park. A lot of the students were visibly shaken, and, my own daughter said she's a little afraid to be out in public right now, so I know it's going to take the students a while to process this. There were grief counselors offering help at the fairgrounds, and, the community trying to pull together to deal with this tragedy.
Right on. Now, when is the vigil tonight?
I've heard there's a vigil at 8 p.m. at Stewart Park, and it seems like other people are working on other vigils as well. It's so fresh that I'm not sure of the extent of the community response, but people are pulling together.
John, thank you so much.
I appreciate it, and pray for the victims' families.
Indeed. We all will. I've been speaking with John Sajo. He is a political activist and a resident of Douglas County. Thank you, John.
You bet. Talk to you later, then.
Talk to you later. This is Doug McVeigh for KABU News.
This morning's mass shooting is only the latest in a long list of such events in the United States, which have gripped the public consciousness and sparked a heated, if stagnant, national debate over gun control. A number of these shootings occurred in Oregon and the larger Pacific Northwest. On December 11, 2012, a man shot and killed two people before turning the gun himself at a shopping center in Clackamas. The last year and a half alone has seen three school shootings in the region. One person was fatally wounded and two others injured in a shooting at Seattle Pacific University in June of 2014. That same month at Reynolds High School in Troutdale, a student killed a 14-year-old boy before turning the gun on himself when confronted by police. In December of 2014, four students were injured at Rosemary Anderson High School in Portland when three teenagers fired multiple rounds into a crowd of students on lunch break. This incident was widely described by police and media as a gang-related shooting rather than a school shooting, prompting observers to question a racial bias in the reporting of mass shootings since both the shooters and victims were black. However, the Rosemary Anderson shooting and others have all prompted law enforcement agencies in the state to step up their training procedures to better respond to such events. Oregon's Department of Public Safety Standards and Training, or DPSST, has been training many of the smaller law enforcement agencies in Oregon. I spoke with Eric Skablix, the director of the DPSST, for more. Can you tell me a little bit about DPSST's procedures for active shooter trainings?
This is kind of a multi-prong approach. So obviously for any school, for any office-type setting, the first step obviously is prevention. How do we restrict people's access? And it may be as basic as having guests sign in and giving them a visitor's badge all the way to what doors are locked or open when the school or business is open. And every organization's working on prevention. The second part is a plan. What if an incident happens? And it may not be an active shooter incident specific. Specifically, but that plan may include active shooter, it may include earthquake, it may include fire. So what do the people in the building, whether they're employees, staff, or guests, what do they do during an emergency? And then the part that we're really involved in is the response piece, which is helping those local law enforcement agencies train together if they were to respond to a school-type shooting event. And then there's another component that we've been working with the Fire Chiefs Association the last year, and that is providing training to the EMS responders and how they would work on a mass casualty type active shooter event. But I think the question really that you know is the change is years ago, your listeners probably remember the tragic incident that happened in Columbine, where the local law enforcement agency kept the person in the building and sealed it off and created a perimeter, but waited until the SWAT team arrived. So really the big change in philosophy is to get in law enforcement officers as soon as they arrive to stop the threat as soon as possible. As your listeners know, that the SWAT team isn't on duty 24 hours a day. That's a resource that's called in when needed. So really the change in philosophy, not only in Oregon, but across the country, has been for an active shooter event, we need to get people inside the building right away. And that may be people that are just two officers together, and that may be a city officer and a state trooper, a tribal officer and a county deputy. It doesn't matter. They'll go in right away, and they'll try to isolate the threat and neutralize it if possible.
And this training, are you invited by the local communities to do it?
We are. We're invited by the local agencies. So for your listening area, you've got kind of two different groups. You have the larger agency, so Portland Police Bureau, Clackamas County Sheriff's Office, Washington County Sheriff's Office. They do the training in-house with their staff, and we've obviously worked with them, and they've worked with us. So we're all kind of working off of that same lesson plan. But then we're reaching out really to the smaller communities that don't have a full-time training section. So that would be the smaller agencies like a Gladstone, like a Cornelius. So we're going to those communities where they're asking us to come in and help. But what we also do when we do that is that we invite the neighboring agencies, so those agencies responding on an incident. So if you have a small community that has one or two officers on duty, they would be bringing in the agencies around them that would be responding to that incident. And that's what you saw today in Roseburg. You had the sheriff's office assisted by the local police department of Roseburg, by the state police, and either other agencies that came in to assist. And you also saw that a few years ago up in Troutdale when we had the tragic incident there.
All right, Mr. Gablix, thank you very much for talking with us today.
Okay, thank you, Sam.
For KBOO Community Radio, this is Sam Bowman speaking with Eric Skablix, the director of the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training.
Mass shootings like the one today in Roseburg have become almost commonplace in the U.S. and are far more common here than in other countries, except these countries, which are engaged in open warfare. Professor Eric Mankowski of Portland State University spoke with KBOO's Jenka Soderberg about the impact of these shootings on our collective psyche and how we can move away from a culture of fear.
Can you talk about what some of the social and societal factors are that lead to this type of violence?
Well, we can't ever make predictions accurately about any particular individual's behavior or violent firearm usage. So in this case, we can talk about general factors that across these incidents seem to be related. One of the things that I've highlighted a lot in my work is gender, that most of the, almost exclusively the shooters are socialized as men, and there's a lot that goes along with that in the United States around the anti-femininity, the achievement, the kind of self-reliance and aggression that are socialized along with masculinity in the U.S. culture. So that's a big set of factors right there. The others involved, I know that a sense of entitlement perhaps among some men who feel that violence is a way or a solution to bring justice to a situation in which they felt aggrieved or that they haven't had the privilege that they deserve as men. Those are some of the key factors. We think that they're, you know, that's related potentially to economic injustices that men perceive as women have gained increasing roles and increasing power in their social roles over time. There may be some sense that some men feel that they have experienced a sense of injustice as they've been displaced from some of their traditional roles in society. But really, these are economic conditions rather than gendered conditions. So there's a difference between the perception that men have about the causes of violence or aggression and the truer underlying ones having to do with economic forces often.
People who have an experience with mental illness or who have a diagnosis of mental illness tend to be targeted after these types of incidents where mental illness is blamed. And American Psychological Association, an organization that you're a part of, has found that that link is kind of spurious, that it isn't people with mental illness who are necessarily the problem. And I wonder if you could talk a little about that.
Sure. The association between mental illness and gun violence is spurious, as you indicate. There isn't any data to indicate that people who have been diagnosed with mental illness are more likely to commit violence with firearms. The data don't allow us to draw any conclusions about mental health factors being causal of this kind of gun violence. There is a perception, I think, and the reporting often focuses on that feature. Unfortunately, what we know is that the vast majority, almost exclusively, all of these school-based shootings are perpetrated by males, and we tend not to talk about how gender is related. Where there are folks who may have had experiences of mental illness in their life, that tends to become one of the big factors that our reporting gets focused on, and it's simply not empirically supported with the data that there's an increased probability of gun violence with someone who is experiencing or has experienced mental illness.
Again, I've been speaking with Professor Eric Mankowski. He is a professor at Portland State University in applied social and community psychology, and his focus is on domestic violence, gun violence, gender violence. This is Jenka Soderberg with KBOO News.
Yesterday, U.S. Representative from Maryland, Chris Van Hollen, and Maryland Attorney General Brian E. Frosch called for other states to join Maryland in requiring licenses to purchase handguns, saying the rule works best to stem gun violence when it applies across jurisdictions. During a news conference with other gun control advocates at a Baltimore County courthouse, the officials said that firearms tend to flow from states that lack permit-to-purchase laws to those that have them, with guns often landing in the hands of criminals. 10 states and the District of Columbia have licensing requirements for handguns, but the Maryland border states of Pennsylvania, West Virginia, and Virginia do not. Van Hollen, potential Democratic nominee for the Senate, has introduced legislation that would provide financial incentives for states to adopt purchasing laws similar to the one that Maryland enacted in 2013, which requires fingerprinting and licensing. Maryland's Attorney General pointed to studies from the Johns Hopkins Center for Gun Policy and Research, which found that gun-related homicides dropped by 40% over 10 years in Connecticut after the state adopted a permit-to-purchase law in 1995. In Missouri, on the other hand, gun-related homicides increased by 25% after the state repealed a similar statute in 2007.
You're listening to the KABU Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth look at a research center for the deaf in India, which marks a new era of deaf rights in that country. This will be followed by Rose City Native Radio at 6. At 7, it's Ear to the Streets of Portland, featuring conversations around organizing in the Black African community in Portland and surrounding areas. Tomorrow's weather will be partly cloudy, with a high of 68 and a low of 48. Today in history, in 1946, sentences were read out on Nazi leaders at the end of the Nuremberg trials. 23 Nazi officials were tried for war crimes, with 12 eventually being given the death sentence. In 1965, a coup attempt called the 30th of September Movement was put down in Indonesia, precipitating weeks of violent reprisals against alleged communists in which hundreds of thousands of Indonesians were killed. The quote of the day is from comedian Bill Hicks. "I hate patriotism. I can't stand it. It was a round world the last time I checked."
At yesterday's city council meeting, the city heard from local resident Trina Sutton about her backyard homeless camp. Her testimony came just as the city of Portland announced that $30 million will be devoted to the city's housing emergency to try to provide more resources and housing for people who are homeless.
I came here to talk about a proposed transitional area called My Backyard. That's the name we chose for it. But it was, I had a really unique experience last night. I went to Gresham City Council. They finally figured out they have homeless in Gresham. So it was packed. We had 150 people there, standing room only. And I am not going to embellish this one little bit. It's on record. Police, everybody, presidents of neighborhood associations, faith-based community, civic organizations, private citizens, every single person that stood up and talked said the only viable answer right now is to put in more transitional areas. Now, these are not overnighters. These are people who would go and be in a safe place and transition into permanent housing, get back into the community. My people in the Central Southeast, which is off of 82nd, that is what they want. We cannot confuse, which I applaud the gentleman over here, criminality with homelessness. They're not synonymous. The homeless people that I represent do not want the criminals there anymore. Sometimes their lives involve criminal activity such as drug use. So what I'm saying is we need to be progressive here. And I want to really applaud Mayor Hales over this declaration of emergency for homeless. That is very progressive. Something else Mayor Hales did, he went out with a couple of my friends that are park rangers and visited my people over there. And I knew he was going, but I chose to not go out there. David asked me to, one of the park rangers. And I said, no, I don't want to influence. You need to go out, and I want him to see what I see every single day. I need to put many people in two areas. I have so many allies. This is not a Trina Sutton project. This, I don't bring my board in because they work during the day. I have to have something tangible. There is a piece of property on 105th and Foster. Now, a police officer brought this to my attention. He also brought it to my attention that his brother up in Washington has shipping containers that he's willing to donate. Those are $2,000 a piece to get here. And he already renovated shipping containers for the U.S. Marshals Service. We can put people into these transitional camps, give them safety that are drug and alcohol free, 24-hour security, just like Right to Dream 2, and give them a real shot at succeeding in life, because they're not safe out there either. I don't know if anyone here would have been aware of it. We had a predator over there who sexually assaulted a 66-year-old man. U.S. Marshals were looking for him, Clackamas Sheriff's Office, Portland Police, transit cops got him. But you know how they got him? Because homeless people provided the intel to get him. They don't want the drug dealers out there. They don't want any of these people out there. People have got to stop confusing criminals with homeless. They are not the same.
Thank you very much, Trina. Thank you for what you're doing. Thanks. Okay.
That was Trina Sutton from Southeast Portland, speaking about her efforts to establish a homeless encampment in outer Southeast Portland at the Portland City Council.
Today was the first day for retail marijuana sales in Oregon. KABU reporter Jim Thompson went to a Hillsboro dispensary to talk with customers waiting in line.
It has begun!
So do you have any plans for the rest of the day?
After I leave here, I'm going to go hang out with some friends and celebrate.
How long have you been here?
Only since 8:40, yeah, something like that. Nice people. We've just been talking to everybody, and everybody's smiling. It's a good time.
About time.
No more prohibition.
I'm just happy it's legalized, and I don't have to go to my weed man anymore. I could just come here.
Oh, this is kind of an interesting turnout. I'm a little concerned with the OLCC, the way they've rolled everything out. I'm a medical grower, and I'm worried about my patients not being able to buy stuff because the recreational will take all the stock. So they're going to have some growing issues.
What do you think it will do to prices?
Well, they're going to try to, I would imagine, trying to keep it low, but it's good. I don't think it's going to close the black market out at all, because they've got lower prices than anybody else. So people buy like Walmart. They go to the cheapest prices.
$1 billion worth of pot is confiscated in the United States of America, but it takes over $15 billion to prosecute those people.
That was KABU reporter Jim Thompson speaking with customers waiting in line this morning at Shango's, a dispensary in Hillsboro. Many existing licensed medical cannabis dispensaries in the state open their doors to anyone over the age of 21. Retail customers at dispensaries are only allowed to purchase up to a quarter ounce per day. The state imposed that limit to ensure that retail customers could not buy out a shop's entire stock, leaving patients to fend for themselves. Some shops are also giving patients a discounted price. KABU reporter Doug McVeigh spoke with Mike Mullins from Stony Girl Gardens, a dispensary in Clackamas County, to see how opening day went.
Did you think you were going to see this day come this soon?
In reality, I never thought I'd see this day come this quickly, and we really have to honor all of those before us who made this happen. I really want to thank all of those pioneers out there who have put their lives on the line to be able to make this day happen.
Tell me about Stony Girl Gardens, first of all.
Well, Stony Girl Gardens was a group of patients that worked together. We started very early on in 1998 in providing access to patients and providing training and knowledge. We did that because we had to help ourselves. We'll never forget the day that we were given our Oregon medical card and kicked to the curb and said, "Good luck, sucker." And then at that time, there was very little resources available. So we strive to create those resources and help patients, enable patients for themselves. We've certainly watched the industry do a lot of growing. We started out as a seed company, quickly went to a company that was where we did a lot of training opened up our Port Amsterdam University because we felt that just supplying people seeds wasn't enough. They needed to know how to grow them and be successful. We believe in being transparent. We love our patients. They're our first base of operation and will always be our focus. Of course, we have recreation today, which we had to acknowledge the additional sales, but still want to make sure that we focus on patients. And that is one of our concerns as we go forward. I think one of the things that we need to look at as we face the new recreational avenue is, number one, we have a newfound freedom, but we should always make sure that we maintain the responsibility of having that freedom and working with marijuana and keeping it away from children, of course. But as far as the medical marijuana patient goes, they're quickly losing ground to being able to have good quality access to products that they need that are different from the recreational crowd. We have two separate counters here for a particular reason. Number one, the recreational sales are limited. But number two, the recreational, as we go forward, will be a different product altogether than what the consumer for the medical marijuana market needs. In the medical marijuana side, we will have things such as suppositories and pills and enema kits and all kinds of different things like that that actually will have medical application. One of the concerns I have with recreational is that we lose all of the supposed medical values because they are not FDA approved. They will not be allowed to be put on the package for the recreational side. Nor does the recreational consumer necessarily care about those types of effects. They're more into the flavor and the experience. But here we are today. I'm so excited. We're really making history. We're the third nation, the third state in the nation, and it's very exciting to be a participant in that.
So far, you've had a steady flow of people coming in. You have a handful of folks over here at the patient side, slightly more over here on the retail side, taking advantage of the first day of sales. Actually, curious, you decided not to do the midnight opening that a handful of the other dispensaries in town did. Why is that?
There are two reasons. Number one, we don't want to be open for the after-bar crowds, etc. That's not the people that we actually serve. The average patient or the average individual that has come in here today is 57 years old, and so they're usually not out and about at 3 o'clock in the morning. The other side of that is that Clackamas County has an ordinance that only allows us to run from 10 a.m. to 9 p.m. at night. So as we go forward, there are a number of ordinances being made by counties and cities that will create time, place, and manner if they even allow it. We certainly have an abundance of people coming in the door this morning. We opened at 10 a.m. We did not have people standing around the block or camping overnight like you would for the new cell phone, which was probably expected by many of the dispensaries in Portland. We are famous here in Oregon for having access to some of the best products in the world, so the consumer here is not as caught up with having to get to the stores quickly. And as I say, our average consumer is 57 years old. They're working people who are taking advantage of their newfound freedom, and more so than the glitz of a new cell phone.
Right on. Well, I know that you've got a lot of work to do. You got people on both sides who are trying to get your attention, and you've got a line of people not quite out the door. Mike Mullins, Stony Girl Gardens, thank you so much.
Thank you very much for coming by.
This is Doug McVeigh for KBOO News.
Over 100 local residents of Clackamas County packed a hearing in Oregon City this morning to voice opposition to a new housing development that will destroy 300 ancient Doug fir trees in the neighborhood known as Jennings Lodge. Lennar Corporation, the development company, is the nation's second largest home builder. Lennar has several subdivisions in the Portland suburbs. Most homes are priced in the $350,000 to $450,000 range. The opponents to the clear cut are concerned about surface water runoff, the loss of historic buildings, increased traffic, and the danger posed by more cars on Southeast River Road, where there are no sidewalks. About 8,000 people live in the unincorporated area just north of Gladstone. The area is owned by the Pacific Conference of the Evangelical Church of America, which sold the lot to Lennar. Some Jennings Lodge residents unsuccessfully lobbied Clackamas County in 2013 to acquire the land for a park. About 40 church buildings will be razed in the development of the area, and some residents lament that it will be a rich piece of history lost without a trace. KBOO's Jenka Soderberg was there and spoke with Joshua Green, one of the neighbors of the property, who spoke against the plan.
The plan is to cut 326 trees down. that essentially sequester, you know, the rainfall and keep the heat index down and basically create habitat for, you know, our neighborhood and stuff. I had a deer walking through my front yard the other day. We have skunks, we have raccoons, we have possums, we have coyotes, we have everything out there. So letting Lennar Homes come in and with their proposal to change the zoning from R10 to R8.5 and put in 72 high-density single-family homes is ridiculous. You know, it's just out of character of the entire neighborhood, which is zoned R10. So I'm completely against it. You know, it just doesn't fit the neighborhood.
And I understand there's also issues with possible erosion.
Yeah, we don't have any actual storm runoff in our neighborhood. We're actually unincorporated area, and so is Oak Grove. So we're kind of underserved as it is, and this is kind of like a double-edged sword. It's kind of the county's way of saying, well, maybe you'd have better, you know, coverage if you would incorporate, right? But, you know, we don't want to incorporate. I mean, we're happy with the way things are, except for the fact that things like this can just kind of, you know, happen to us. So hopefully we'll be able to make changes to these zoning laws and in the future be able to help stop this, because right now we're going through quite a big building phase. I mean, this isn't the only piece of property that's under attack. There's multiple places, and if the zoning changes here, I would have to assume that at the bottom of Hillside Drive, which is right down the street, there's a proposal for, I think, about 13 homes right on the Willamette River itself in this even a smaller lot. So if this goes through, I would have to assume that they would try to push that through.
That was Clackamas County resident Joshua Green. The Planning Commission did not make any decision today, but heard testimony from more than 50 local residents opposed to the 72-unit housing development.
The agency assembly to oversee the disbursement of $840 billion in stimulus funds officially closed their doors Wednesday night, leaving many questions as to what will become of the public's access to the records. The Recovery, Accountability, and Transparency Board was comprised of several inspectors general from a variety of federal bureaus and chaired by Kathleen Tai, who acts in that capacity for the Department of Education. The Recovery Board listed its accomplishments in an early September press release, claiming a total of 3,200 audits that ultimately recovered more than $150 million and better than 1,600 convictions. Notable anomalies in recovery expenditures include 28 fraudulent Medicare providers in Miami and an employee of the Department of Housing and Urban Development buying real estate with agency funds and selling them for profit. A recent study conducted by the Government Accountability Office found that there's an 18% increase, reflecting a $19 billion jump in improper payments between fiscal years 2014 and 2013. KBOO contacted a number of watchdog agencies regarding the closure, but none were available for comment before our deadline. We will continue to follow the story in coming weeks.
In Afghanistan, the National Army pushed Taliban fighters from the strategic northern city of Kunduz this morning amid fierce street fighting that is still ongoing. The Taliban had captured the city on Monday, which the Afghan army has struggled to defend in the absence of U.S. and NATO forces, though there was a limited U.S. Special Forces presence in the recent battles for the city. Kunduz is a city of just over 300,000 people and occupies a strategic position on the highway between Mazar-i-Sharif and the capital of Kabul. The Taliban has denied losing control of the city, with their spokesman claiming that their flag still flies over the city. However, the Afghan army has announced that they have removed major roadblocks and begun delivering food and other supplies to the population. The Afghan war remains one of the world's longest and most intractable conflicts, with the landlocked nation experiencing an almost uninterrupted state of war since 1979, including Soviet invasion, civil war, U.S. invasion, and the ongoing Taliban insurgency, in addition to smaller localized conflicts.
And now, the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center at www.imemc.org for Thursday, October 1st, 2015. Israeli soldiers invade homes in Jerusalem, kidnap civilians. Meanwhile, troops take over a Palestinian home in Hebron. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. Dozens of Israeli soldiers invaded on Thursday at dawn various Palestinian neighborhoods and towns in occupied East Jerusalem, searched homes and attacked families, wounding several Palestinians and kidnapped 12. The soldiers also fired rubber-coated steel bullets inside an invaded home, wounding one Palestinian. Soldiers stormed and violently searched homes in Al-Asawiyyah town in Jerusalem and kidnapped 12 young Palestinians, including children, local sources reported. Late on Wednesday night, Israeli soldiers kidnapped two Palestinians in Ain Abus village south of the northern West Bank city of Nablus and violently assaulted another Palestinian in Madaba village south of Nablus. The Palestinian Prisoner Society, PPS, has reported that Israeli soldiers kidnapped 562 Palestinians, including dozens of children, mainly in occupied East Jerusalem in September. The PPS said that soldiers kidnapped 294 Palestinians, mainly children, in Jerusalem, and that most of them were taken prisoner after Israeli extremists and soldiers intensified their invasions into Al-Aqsa Mosque. Elsewhere, the Israeli army issued Thursday a military order occupying a Palestinian home in Halhul town, north of Hebron, in the southern part of the occupied West Bank. The property owner lives in the United States. Media sources in Hebron said that soldiers occupied the home of Fathi Muhammad Mir'ib in the northern part of Halhul town and that the illegally seized property is located next to Karmet Sur illegal colony built on privately Palestinian lands. The sources said that Mir'ib lives in the United States and that the soldiers stormed the property while his nephew Nidal Samih Karaja was there and handed him an order informing the family that the military will be taking control of the property for military considerations. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News.